There is nothing quite as pure or as fierce as the love of a childhood hero. For me, it was Mickey Mantle. For you, Muhammad Ali, maybe, or Martina Navratilova, or Nomar Garcia Parra. You may obsess over what he or she wears, eats, drinks, thinks, devour every word written about them, and imagine conversations that you would have if you would ever meet. And then one day you outgrow it. The love wanes. Your interests broaden, but you never really forget. What would it be like to meet your hero? 20 years after he moved on to college and girls and rock and roll, Stephen Dubner saw a picture of his childhood hero on a magazine cover and determined to meet him. What would you talk about with your hero? Could you find that old loving feeling once again? Or are heroes better left to past glory? Join the conversation. Our number is 800-989-TALK. Our email address, TOTN@NPR.org. And joining us now is Stephen Dubner. His new book is called Confessions of a Hero Worshipper, and he's in our bureau in New York. Welcome.
Hi, Neil. Thanks very much.
Your hero was Franco Harris, the great running back who helped elevate the Pittsburgh Steelers from decades of mediocrity and worse. There's one moment, one play, that electrified you as a small boy, and it is, of course, known as the Immaculate Reception.
Bradshaw running out of the pocket, looking for somebody to throw to, fires it downfield, and there's a collision. It's cut out of the air. The ball is pulled in by Franco Harris. Harris is going for a touchdown for Pittsburgh. Harris is going.
Stephen Dubner, you write about watching that on your 13-inch black-and-white TV set in your home in upstate New York. What was it like?
You know, it was one of those moments. It's funny that it was later named the Immaculate Reception, because obviously it that's a name that connotes a miracle or something, you know, close to miraculous at least. And watching that moment and watching the play, it was this strange deflection, and there was that moment of uncertainty and a moment that uncertainty that seemed to foreshadow gloom, the end of the season for the Steelers, and then a rash alteration of what we had expected to be the case, which was Franco Harris catching this ball and scoring a touchdown and claiming a victory. And I guess what it represented to me on a big level, which I certainly didn't understand as a 10-year-old boy, was that when life presents you with impossible circumstances or with what appears to be misery, somehow you may find something wonderful and miraculous growing out of it. Probably not very likely. May never happen to you, but just the thought that it can happen is quite an encouraging thought for a lonely little boy in the middle of the boondocks in upstate New York.
You write about, you did research about hero worship as you wrote this book, and one of the things I was fascinated by was what the experts call berging. Explain that to me.
Berging is a lovely acronym for basking in reflected glory, by which we, sports fans especially, that's where it's been most studied, tend to experience a great surge both psychologically and physiologically when your team or the athlete or whoever it is that you're rooting for succeeds. There was a great study done in the World Cup, I guess in 1992, 94, when it was played in Atlanta. Male soccer fans from Brazil and Italy, whose two teams were meeting in the final, scientists measured their saliva, which carries testosterone, before the match and then after, and the saliva of the winning team's fans rose by about 27%. Excuse me, the testosterone level rose about 27%, while the losing fans lost about that much, which is to say that there was this great, great hormonal surge. And it happens whether you're a kid or whether you're an adult. You actually do receive this boost if you root for a team. On the other hand, if you pick the wrong team, or if your particular athlete suffers great indignities or losses, you can really suffer from that too. That often leads to what's called corfing, cutting off reflected failure, or coughing, cutting off future failure. If you really want to wimp out and don't even want to take a chance, you'll cough, cut off future failure by just saying, you know what, I can't take rooting for the Red Sox anymore, or whoever it is, the Cubs anymore, and just decide that you're going to go through life without that rooting.
And it's interesting, for you and for me, it was sports figures, but one of the things you write about is you describe the story of celebrity and heroes through time, and particularly in this last 100 years or so, that sports figures are all that's left as real heroes.
Yeah, it's a question I went out to answer because it so befuddled me why it was that millions of theoretically intelligent young people, maybe you, maybe I, people like us, Why on earth would it be that of all the people out there to admire and turn into heroes, why it would be the athlete? There are some obvious answers. It's a dramatic pursuit. We get to watch it happen live, unscripted, and all these things. But I think one of the biggest reasons why, especially in that generation, kind of from the mid-60s on, was that all the other traditional bastions of hero worship and the institutions that created heroes, whether it was the military or the government or religion or our own households, all of those institutions were called into question during that time, during the 1960s. And so we began to challenge organized religion. We began to challenge certainly the government and certainly the military. And even our own parents, we were told, you know, that they did not represent our best interests always.
No, they were over 30 after all.
Yeah. Exactly. And athletes, not only were they real, performing these real feats, but they were also a little bit not real, too. They just would show up once a week or once a day if they were a baseball player, and they would perform these feats. And television, of course, has this wildly seductive way of amplifying the victories and amplifying the struggles. And it's extraordinarily intoxicating. And I think even though now we talk about how much sport has become over-commercialized, and I would agree with that to a large degree, even so, you see the grip that it has, not just on young people, but on us. I mean, with the world so complicated as it is now, sometimes it really is fun to sit down and watch a ball game because it is essentially uncomplicated, and it is essentially you do gain an absolute glimpse of the way things can be in that there's a win or there's a loss,
and
whereas the rest of the world is so gray.
And there's no script. They've got to actually go out and do it.
Which I think is one of the reasons why when there is a sports scandal, when someone throws a game, you know, the Chicago Black Sox, City University basketball, when that happens in sport, it really is a tragedy. Politics, we expect it, and we almost accept it to the point now. But with sport, we realize it is supposed to be true, it is supposed to be honest, and it is supposed to happen, you know, kind of with full transparency. And it's that kind of transparency we're really not used to seeing very much in the real world today.
Our phone number is 800-989-8255. Our email address, totn@npr.org. And Wes joins us on the line from Phoenix, Arizona.
Hello, Neil. Neil, I love your show. I know you hear that all the time.
Well, thanks very much.
I'm actually from Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and a friend of mine and I were going to play tennis one time, and I said, I need to go by my apartment and get some tennis balls. And he said, oh, that'll be fine. I said, Steve, you like Jimmy Taylor, the old fullback for the Green Bay Packers, because that was one of his heroes. And he said, well, why don't you come up and meet Mr. Taylor? I used to live in one of Mr. Taylor's apartment complexes. I said, he's up caulking my bathtub right now in my bathroom. And my friend Steve says, oh, come on. You know, Jim Taylor's not upstairs in your apartment. I said, oh, yeah, he sure is. So we go up there, and I introduced him to Jimmy Taylor. He used to play for Vince Lombardi, the first Super Bowl champion, Green Bay Packers. And his jaw just hit the floor, and he never let me forget it. It was really something just to see his face. And
was he in the bathtub?
He's still a real pillar in the community, and just a soft-spoken, true gentleman, and a very hands-on apartment manager also, I might add. But
go, Steve Dubner. You had a question?
Hey, Wes, was he in the bathtub when you went up to see him?
He was actually standing in the bathtub with a caulk gun in his hand, smearing the caulk with his finger.
Uh-huh.
And there was a fellow with him, and, you know.
Oh, a caulking gun. I thought you said a cocked gun.
Oh, a caulk gun.
Yeah, caulk. That's better.
Oh, let's not get violent on the radio.
Well, no, I was just thinking of Jimmy Taylor's fingers. That must have been, you know, about an inch-wide strip of caulk there that he was putting down.
That's really funny because my friend said, you know, he looks like he could still play. And
I was envisioning the story differently. I somehow heard it as you barged into him in his bathroom, and he was there with a shotgun ready to take care of you.
That's why you're the writer and he's the phone caller.
I'm the paranoia.
Getting that straight then.
Wes, thanks very much for the call.
Thanks a lot, Neil. We do love your show.
Appreciate it. Never hear that quite enough.
Go Tigers, go Jim.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And now let's go to Colin, who's with us from San Francisco.
Hi. I like to just say I enjoy your show a lot. My story is more about kind of the rejection of a hero, in a way, through his actions. I have always been a big soccer fan, which is very strange, being an American. And my hero was Diego Armando Maradona, which a lot of people don't know, is a famous soccer player.
All I remember is the hand of God.
Yes, yes. And we're the same physical types. I'm kind of a short, fat Italian guy who likes to play soccer. I always played soccer all my life. And I wrote an essay about him in the seventh grade, and I remember just telling all my friends how I want to just copy him and be like him. And then, like, 2 weeks later when the essay is due, I hand it in, and then he's indicted for cocaine, and he's indicted for drugs. And then after that, his kind of career went into a downward spiral. And, you know, luckily to this day, I'm still a soccer fan. I taught in Japan, and I taught ESL, and I was over there, luckily, for the World Cup. So my love of the sport hasn't waned, but my kind of love in heroes has waned a lot. I want to know if that kind of happens to a lot of people who have heroes that kind of hit rock bottom.
Mm-hmm. Stephen Dubner?
Well, Colin, yeah, I mean, you learned, you know, the valuable, true, and, you know, hurtful lesson, which is that there was a great quotation from the 17th century, "No man is a hero to his valet." The better you know someone, anyone, of course, whether it's a hero or a friend or a spouse or someone else in your family, you know the flaws. The whole act of hero worship is one in which you do your best, your mind does its best to kind of eliminate the flaws and accentuate the positive. It's one of the reasons why I feel that hero worship has a great deal in common with a couple other fierce human attachments, religious faith and romantic love. Psychologists call these three things the urge to merge, the means by which we attach ourselves to someone outside and greater than ourselves that we think will somehow complete us or lift us up. And, often there's that first stage of infatuation where you think they're just perfect and wonderful. And then often slowly we grind that down. And then if an ugly fact can poke its way through, we begin to tear them down entirely. It's the Oedipal complex. We see it repeatedly throughout myth-making, throughout psychology, and so on. It's an artificial construct to think that we can keep and love a hero forever because humans don't work that way, but heroes are a little bit different. And the first heroes, in the days of antiquity, there was no such thing as a living hero. And that's, I think, where we've made this error, is electing to have living heroes, because while they're still alive, they can make mistakes. And if they make a mistake, we'll find out about it. And once we find out about it, we think of them differently, even though we should realize that, of course, they're human and flawed as we are.
Let's get a call from Laura now, who's in Waltham, Massachusetts.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes, I'm calling to talk about Judy Blume. Was actually my childhood hero.
The writer, yes.
Yes, and I was actually saying when I first got on the phone that a lot of my expressions as a child, I actually took right from Judy Blume books. I used to write in her book, starring Sally J. Freeman as herself, I used to sign my letters "Love and Other Indoor Sports." Like.
Well, Steve Dubner used to sign your homework as Franco Dubner.
It's true. You know, I love to hear the stories about a writer as the hero. In fact, there's a nice piece by Bob Lipsight in the New York Times today, the Writers on Writing section, where he says that Judy Blume may be the most influential writer for, you know, generations of young people, which I would tend to agree with. You know, it's so amazing and interesting always to find out what it was that turns a person on to whatever that is they get turned on to, because, you know, our parents are meant to be our first heroes. That's the way the biology works. And in my case, I had an extreme case in that my father died when I was a kid, when I was 10, and reached out to someone who could substitute for him. But, you know, it sounds like Laura, you know, all of us have at some point, you want something beyond what your little mind can create on its own. And how we go about finding that is endlessly fascinating and often really wonderfully uplifting. Some people don't choose their heroes so well and they get penalized for it, but it sounds like Laura is pretty happy with hers.
Oh, thank you. Well, I don't know if I have time for a quick comment. I actually sort of met Judy Blume. I was working at a bookstore. I'm a librarian now. And I got all nervous and all I did was smile at her, and I'm so sorry.
That's called, it's a professional problem, Laura. It's called acute awe. And Stephen Dubner, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Neil.
Stephen Dubner's book is Confessions of a Hero Worshipper, and this is NPR News.